Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT podcast. Today we're going to talk about lactate, specifically lactate in septic patients. But before we get there, I have a very important announcement. The MCRIT blog and podcast has now moved to mcrit.org, emcrit.org. What was at mcrit.org before was the MCRIT web text. The web text is now at text.mcrit.org, text.mcrit.org, and the blog and podcast is now taken over the main domain at mcrit.org. Your iTunes feed should all work just fine without you changing anything. And if you forget and you go to the original address, blog.mcrit.org, everything will just transfer over automatically. You don't have to remember this, but you don't have to put in that blog anymore. Just put in mcrit.org. And if you want the web text, go to text.mcrit.org. That's because at this point, the blog and podcast have transcended the web text in terms of the true representation of MCRIT. The text has kind of got pushed into the background. It's now all about the podcast, baby. Now, just a quick comment on last episode on traumatic arrest. One of the listeners, a gentleman by the name of Scott Gallagher, wrote in to say, well, what about when you have a patient in traumatic arrest with ventricular fibrillation secondary to commotio cordis? And he said, wouldn't you still shock this patient and consider antiarrhythmics? And he sent a very nice New England Journal article, and he is absolutely correct. That is one instance where standard medical ACLS still applies to trauma patients, is these folks who have VTAC without a pulse or ventricular fibrillation because they took a shot to the chest, whether it be from a baseball or a skier hitting a tree. If you find a patient in VFib, by all means shock them. And if they stay in VFib or VTAC, by all means give them some amio or whatever antidysrhythmic you like, and keep on shocking, because this is more of a medical situation than a trauma pathophysiology. So thank you, Scott Gallagher. Now let's get to the meat of the show. So as some of you know, because I've spoken about it in previous podcasts, I'm doing a huge collaborative with New York City, thanks to the folks at Greater New York Hospital Association. One of my intensivist friends, Mark Rosen, and I are co-chairing this collaborative, and what we're trying to do is create a translation of all the sepsis literature to actually make it work at the bedside in a real clinical environment in the ED. Now, if you haven't seen the resources for this, just go to the website, which is now at mcrit.org, and go to the toolbar on top and check out Deep Dive. That's where we really delve into a subject. And click sepsis. And what you'll see is you'll see a bunch of protocols, online lectures, evidence, and a whole bunch of stuff that we're giving to the folks in New York City to make this collaborative work. Well, I'm going to be giving that same stuff to you folks who listen to the podcast. The most recent thing we did for this collaborative is we've been getting a ton of questions regarding lactate. So we did a webinar on all of those questions and the answers we've come up with to learn everything you need to know about lactate for septic patients. So here it is. There is a handout in the show notes as well that has all the references for everything I'm talking about. So by all means, check that out. And so on to the lactate webinar. A lot of the questions that emerged as we've been moving forward with the collaborative pertain to lactate. For some folks, this is a new lab test for the ED, at least, not commonly used, not in the normal flow of things. And now we're asking for a whole bunch of patients to get this lab test drawn. So we figured we'd go through every possible question that's come up and that was expressed to myself or any of the other folks working with the collaborative and put them all together into one little mini lecture. So here it goes. Everything you always wanted to know about lactate. The first question that comes up is, why do we keep bugging you to send lactates? And the answer is probably better than any other lab test out there for an ED patient, Elevated lactate is associated with badness. If your lactate's high and you don't have a reasonable explanation for why, then your mortality rates are much higher than if your lactate isn't. And some of the studies actually make for an easy correlation. For every one your lactate increases above normal, you have a 10% increased mortality. So those are big numbers. It means on average, if you had a lactate of 8, you have an 80% chance of dying while you're in the hospital. Now, obviously, if you had a more benign cause for it, then your mortality rates aren't so high. But in general, high lactates are bad. And by the same token, if you start with a high lactate and you're able to make the patient better and get their lactate back down to normal, those patients do much better. So it's a test that has prognostic significance. Now, its significance is particularly important in our septic patients because what lactate has to offer, besides its prognostic value, is it is a screen for the early stages of sepsis when the patient's essentially a time bomb but doesn't have outward signs. So if you had a patient whose blood pressure is perfect, mental status is good, they might even be talking to you and saying, yeah, you know, my chest hurts a little and I have this cough and some phlegm, but otherwise I'm not so bad, and their lactate comes back at 5, that's predicted that that's the patient that's going to go on and decompensate. And that's the patient, if you admit to a regular bed in the hospital, might go on to have really bad deterioration and maybe even cardiac arrest. So we make the cutoff of 4 for our lactate as where they get to the point where they're at high risk of that deterioration and mortality in our septic patients. Now, when you look at that cutoff of 4 in the Rivers trial, half of the patients who had a lactate greater than 4 had a systolic blood pressure greater than 90. So 50% of the patients weren't exhibiting hypotension at the time that their lactate was high. And a fifth of the patients in the trial had a MAP greater than 100, which means stone cold normal blood pressure, even though their lactate was greater than 4. Now, those patients whose lactates were high in that trial went on to die with the same alacrity as the hypotensive patients. So it shows that that lactate greater than 4 is a screen and that those patients are really sick. So the next question is to understand is why these lactates are high. And intuitively, and if we think back to physiology, it would be really appealing if the reasons the lactates were high in these patients was because they are not getting enough oxygen to their tissues. And therefore, instead of taking glucose through the Krebs cycle, they put it through anaerobic respiration, and they send that glucose to lactate instead of putting it in the Krebs cycle. That would be intuitively appealing. Unfortunately, it's probably not true. A lot of these guys whose lactates are high are not having global lack of oxygen to their tissues. They're probably not even having regional lack of oxygen to their tissues. I mean, sure, you show me a patient who's really, really bad off and they're not getting any oxygen to their tissues, they're going to have an elevated lactate. But the converse is not true. A lactate of 6 doesn't necessarily mean these patients are having tissue oxygenation problems. So the better way to think about it is lactate is just a general sign of badness. The reason these patients getting elevated lactates are probably from excess catecholamines. It's probably from the cytokines changing the way we metabolize sugar. The lungs are a huge source of lactate. These patients in their septic episodes get very tachypneic, they get hyperpneic, and the lungs like to produce lactate. Lactate is probably an adaptive mechanism by your body. In stress states, your heart, your brain can actually use lactate as a fuel. So this is a system our body's built to allow, when we're running away from an aggressor holding a knife, to continue fueling our heart and lungs and leave that glucose out there for our muscles. But in sepsis, when things are really bad off, then this is spiraling out of control. And as the lactates get higher and higher, it's a marker for patients who are sick. Next question is, how are we actually going about measuring lactate? This has come up a few times. When we talk about a lactate greater than 4, we're talking about millimoles per liter. That is the metric standard. That's how lactates are usually reported. Rarely you'll have a lab reporting in milligrams per deciliter. And the conversion for that to go from milligrams per deciliter to your millimoles is you multiply by 0.111. So we're talking millimoles per liter is the standard. That's what that 4 cutoff is based on. Nice thing about that is that fits right into your anion gap. If you're calculating an anion gap off your chemistry and you have an anion gap of 15 and a lactate of 6, then 6 of that 15 are accounted for by your lactate. And there's probably not too much else going on in terms of metabolic acidosis in that patient, aside from their elevated lactate. So that's nice. You can actually fill your anion gap with your lactate measurement. If we want to be really precise, when we say lactate, we really mean L-lactate. Lactate's a stereoisomer. If you don't know what a stereoisomer is, don't worry about it. It's not clinically useful at all. The only thing to understand is that some of these folks who have had a lot of their small intestine cut out, these folks actually could get D-lactic acidosis. That's not measured by our conventional assays. These patients could be profoundly acidotic, and you send a lactate level, it comes back completely normal. It's because they have a different form of lactic acidosis. For the purpose of sepsis patients, you don't need to worry about that stuff. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, just forget about it. Another question that came up is, what's the difference between lactic acid and lactate? We're talking about lactate for pretty much everything. You might hear the term lactic acid. It doesn't really exist in the body with any great amount. So at normal physiologic pHs, there's about 3,500 times more lactate than lactic acid. Even if you manage to infuse lactic acid, which is really tough to do, that would immediately disassociate to H+ and lactate. All the assays you're going to see are measuring lactate. If you hear the term lactic acid in a clinical setting, they're trying to say lactate, and they're just using a misnomer. So just make those terms synonymous in your mind. So at this point, I got asked a question. What about these lactates between 2 and 4? Isn't there a really high excess mortality with these values as well? From the literature you'll find in your handout, there's certainly an elevated mortality in even these mid-range lactates, the 2.5 you mentioned. I've not seen anything up to 90%. If you have a reference along those lines, please send it to me and I'll take a look and add it to the stuff. But there's more and more emerging work that even lactates that we don't really get excited about, like that 2.5, is still associated with an increased mortality rate. So if you get them from 4 to 2.5, you've cleared the lactate, you fulfilled the criteria of the collaborative, but I wouldn't like blow those patients off at those points. Those guys are still sick, they still have a chance of deterioration, they should still get their lactates trended, but 4 to 2.5, I'm feeling pretty good about that patient. Any other questions before I keep going? All right, well then I'm going to go on. So the next question that's come up a bunch is, do we have to do an arterial stick? And that would be a huge frustration if we did. And the answer is no, you don't need an arterial stick. Venous stick is just fine. Bunch of studies in the handout show you they're pretty much equal for the purposes we're using them for. If there is a discordance, it's usually due to poor technique. If you draw the venous sample right, then it's gonna correlate fairly well with the arterial and close enough for the work we're doing here. We'll talk about what that means to draw it properly in just a sec. If you do have a patient, you didn't draw it yourself, it was even a shift before you got there and some lactate comes back at 7 and you look at the patient, they look like $1 million, you can repeat that value if you just don't trust it. If you really want it to be perfectly accurate, you could send an arterial sample. I don't bother. I just, either under my direct observation or with a nurse or some other practitioner that knows what they're doing, we just send a good venous sample, and that's what we do with these values that just make no sense clinically. But if you have the right clinical setting and the value's high and it was a venous sample, I usually just trust it. I'll give that patient some fluid, and then I'll repeat the lactate and see it come down. The best way we found to actually go about drawing these samples is to use an ABG syringe because it just puts it in the mindset of the person drawing it that this sample is a little bit different than the standard lab. They can't just be chucked on a desk and left there for 45 minutes. If it's in an ABG syringe, people generally treat it a little differently. It gets brought up to the front desk. At most hospitals, they treat that with a little more alacrity than they would otherwise. So we put our lactate samples in a ABG syringe. And it also makes it really easy to draw because when people first start doing this with the ABG syringes, they think they have to take off that vacutainer. But actually, if you take the ABG syringe and push it on the rubber protective portion of the vacutainers, you actually could draw directly into that syringe without taking the vacutainer device off. And I think almost everyone is using vacutainers for their lab draws now. So that's always a big annoyance to the nurses when they think they have to disconnect that vacutainer, put the lactate syringe on, and then put that vacutainer back on. No, you don't need to do that. And if it doesn't make sense what I'm saying, if you just look at the vacutainer and look at an ABG syringe, you'll see you could pop that. It pushes the rubber stopper down, and then you can just pull back on the syringe plunger, and you'll be able to draw into the syringe even though the vacutainer's still on. So that's how we do it, is with ABG syringes. Do you need to take the tourniquet off? And the answer is no. You don't need to take the tourniquet off. Some folks have called me and said, our labs say we have to do this without tourniquet, which means you're putting the tourniquet on, you're getting your IV started, and then you take your tourniquet off to draw the sample, and then the sample's not gonna draw because the veins collapse. It's ridiculous. If your lab even says that, then just tell them you're doing it without the tourniquet, but leave the tourniquet on. What I would say is you probably should make it one of the first couple of samples you draw. So you don't want to draw 8 tubes and then do your lactate. Though chances are that value is not going to be too screwed up if you did, but it's just good practice to get people in the habit of making the lactate your first tube that you draw, or your first thing you draw if you're using those syringes. If you had one of those vein hunt patients where you put the tourniquet on and then you spent a half hour teasing out a tiny little vein, all right, that's when tourniquet effect might have some play in the lactate values. And what I say to do on those folks is you get your IV, you put your vacutainer on, you drop the tourniquet for 15 seconds, and then you just put your tourniquet back on. That will wash out all that built up lactate that was behind the tourniquet, and now you have a nice fresh blood in those veins to sample. So that's what I'll do if it was a long, prolonged hunt for a vein. We recommend, if it's going to be about 15 minutes or more until your sample gets run, you put it on ice. If you have a system where you bring it right up to the front desk, they send it up to the lab, lab runs it right away, you get away without putting it on ice. We're not that lucky. Sometimes it sits for 5 minutes or so we put it on ice. You got to go with your own institution on this. So if it's been more than about 15 minutes, it's been at room temperature, and someone just forgot about it, you probably should chuck the sample, because that's probably when you start getting that increase in your lactate from those cells sitting around there. Next question is, what is an acceptable turnaround time to get results on your lactate? The way this is run at almost every hospital today is on an ABG machine, a blood gas analyzer. If that's how your lab's doing it, the actual test itself takes less than 60 seconds. They have a little tube that pops out of the machine. It sucks up like less than 0.1 cc's of blood, and it spits out a piece of paper with the results in less than 60 seconds. So if your lab is using one of these machines and they're talking about hour, 90-minute turnaround times, then there's a big discordance there between what could be done and what is being done. That's a problem. If, on the other hand, they're not using a blood gas analyzer, then it might take longer. But the answer to that is they probably need to get a blood gas analyzer that could run lactates. For the purposes of the collaborative, we're recommending a 30-minute turnaround time. Your lab should be able to give you a 30-minute turnaround on your lactate results. If they can't, then we should really say we're not able to do the collaborative the way we want. And then they have a couple options. They could get you that 30-minute turnaround time, or it's maybe time to start thinking about a point-of-care analyzer in the ED. These devices are relatively inexpensive from the capital cost perspective. And per sample, depending on what you negotiate, we're talking $1 to $2 per sample. And that's not a lactate sample alone. That gets your ABG, your electrolytes, your creatinine. So it's a big boon to EDs in general. But if your lab is telling you it's 4 hours to get a lactate, it might be time to push for point-of-care in the ED. Question that came up during the collaborative, but I think we put it out there just to make sure it's established, is why can't we just get a regular chemistry and only send a lactate if the anion gap is high or the bicarb is low? Now, that's been looked at first of all in the Rivers trial and then subsequently in a couple more studies, and it doesn't work. A lot of these lactates that are sky high, lactates greater than 4, will have perfectly normal anion gaps and normal bicarbs. In the studies I have here, between 20 and 25%. So you cannot use your chemistry as a screen for elevated lactate. It's just too blunt an instrument. What about false positives? Well, I'll tell you, for the most part, if the lactate's high, it might not necessarily mean the patient is septic, but generally means something bad is going on. But there are some cases where that's not going to be true. First of all, a big one, and unless you know this, you're going to be really surprised when you get sky-high lactates, is any patient taking beta agonists right before you do your lactate is going to have a high lactate. Now, the most common beta agonists in the ED are your albuterol for your asthmatic or COPD patients. And if they got three treatments before they got to the hospital when they were being transported by EMS and then you sent the lactate on arrival, it's going to be high. As soon as those drugs have cleared from the system, the lactate will come down. But any form of beta stimulation, and generally any catecholamines in general, will lead to an elevated lactate. Which means if you have a patient who's really worked themselves up with a horrible hyperventilation spell to the point where they nearly passed out from massive anxiety, they might have a bump in their lactate as well, and that will clear very quickly. But any patient that's having beta stimulation is going to have an elevated lactate, which means if you were actually doing lactates on your marathon runners, they were pretty much fueled by catecholamines their whole run, they're also going to have an elevated lactate. Now, you all know if a patient had a seizure, their lactate is going to be high, and that's probably a combination of the catecholamines and that massive muscle activity. Those patients are generally cleared about 20 minutes after their seizure. You could send a lactate at that point. I try not to send the lactate immediately postictal because it's just going to give me a value I can't do anything with. Liver failure. About 80% of your lactate's cleared by the liver. So if you don't have a functioning liver, it's going to take a lot longer to clear those lactate levels. Problem is that liver failure patients are also prone to really bad sepsis. So generally, if I see an elevated lactate in a hepatic failure patient with signs of infection, then I treat them aggressively. I don't blow it off and say they're liver failure, so that's why their lactate's high. I actually have a higher index of suspicion on these patients for bad sepsis. There's a whole host of toxicologic causes, both direct and indirect. I'm not going to go through them in the call. If you're interested, send me an email. I'll send you my acid-base sheet that has the entire list of drugs that can directly or indirectly elevate your lactate. And then dead gut, dead bowel. If you have a patient, you think they're mesenteric ischemia, they obviously could have high lactates. Then we were opposed to a few clinical situations. And a good one is, patient comes in, they look pretty sick, but their lactate's 3.8, and the assumed second part of that question is that their blood pressure stays with a MAP greater than 65. What do you do on those patients? Well, first off, we're not collecting data on those patients in the collaborative, so you don't have to do any data collection on them. But I will tell you, clinically, you should be really scared of those patients. And they have a tendency to elevate their lactates above 4 if you resend them. So if you show me a lactate at 3.8, 2-3 hours down the line, I'm making sure I'm getting a repeat lactate. If I'm admitting them, I'm going to talk to the floor team that's accepting the patient. And generally, lactate at 3.8, I'd be putting them in a step-down bed type situation, and I'd be making sure they're going to continue trending the lactate to make sure it's going the right direction instead of up. And I'm going to be pretty aggressive with my fluid resuscitation in that patient with a lactate of 3.8. Let's say you had that lactate of 4 and it hit 2.5 after your treatment. You're not totally out of the woods on those patients yet, and generally I'd say Q6 hours, at least for the first day or so, they should get a repeat lactate, make sure it's staying low. Next clinical scenario that gets posed is we had patients who were severely septic, maybe they were hypotensive, that was fluid resistant, and yet their lactates never bumped greater than 2. What gives? And the thing is that they don't go in parallel. You could be profoundly hypotensive, you could be in septic shock, and your lactate will not bump. And generally, those are patients with a underachieving catecholamine system. The prototypical case is your elderly patient. Their adrenals have given up the ghost 10 years ago, and they're not going to be pumping out as much adrenergic drugs, and their lactates might not bump. And I've had patients whose MAPs are in the 20s, and they've required a ton of resuscitation, and their lactate never bumped above 1.8. So on those guys, you've already achieved lactate clearance if that's the way you're playing, and you just have to make sure you've got an aggressive fluid resuscitation and the pressors those patients need. So that's what I have, and I think we're doing well on time, so we have enough time for a bunch of questions if folks still have them about any lactate issue. Next question was on lactate in patients with influenza. So if we're talking like those crappy, you know, runny noses that come in the ED all the time, we bump them out. No, they really shouldn't. But I've seen some patients near death with influenza. And pretty much anything that's going to give you a massive SIRS response could absolutely give you an elevated lactate. But that's actually, I consider, a boon, because those profound influenza patients, they require aggressive resuscitation. And I treat them just like my severe septic patients. My friend and colleague Ruben then asks, what if the consultants from upstairs demand an arterial lactate? There's really no purpose to it. If evidence works on the consultant you're dealing with, then we have enough evidence. If it doesn't, then, you know, there's not too much to say to those folks. What I will say is a venous lactate that's high, there's maybe they'd have a tinge of an argument. A venous lactate that's low, you're really, there's just no excuse for getting an arterial lactate. So venous lactates in some cases will be falsely elevated. They really never, and there's not any physiologic plausibility for why it would be falsely low. So if you get a lactate of 1.6 and they are telling you they want an arterial, well, that's just crazy. But I think the more common circumstance is you have a venous lactate of 5 and they don't believe it. They don't want to accept the patient to the ICU, so they're demanding an arterial. So in your non-code or pericode patients, as long as the samples are drawn properly, there's no reason for there to be a gap. The circumstance where you will start seeing venous side being more representative of the patient is when they really have zero cardiac output. And then your arterial side really represents nothing in terms of the rest of the body. So certainly in those scenarios, if you have a post-cardiac arrest patient immediately after resuscitation, your venous sample actually is a better marker than your arterial. But for these severe sepsis patients that aren't coding, as long as the lactate is properly drawn, there's really no reason to get an arterial sample. And I would just advocate that they come down and do the ABG themselves if they're really that desirous of seeing that result. So I was then asked, at what point do you repeat a lactate after treating the patient when that original lactate was greater than 4? The way we structured the protocols is that the cue for the repeat lactate is when you think you've given the patient enough fluids, you've addressed their hypoxemia, and you've addressed their mean arterial pressure. And that's really when the repeat lactate should get drawn, meaning there is no set time, but for every patient, it's when you've achieved your initial goals, you kind of use the repeat lactate as your check to see if you did it. Now, let's put it in the real world. Sometimes that's gonna happen, sometimes it's not. And if you came into shift and realized the previous guys never sent repeat lactates, even though they gave a ton of fluids, I would say, certainly, before the patient goes upstairs to their bed, there should be a repeat lactate. And if 4 to 6 hours have gone by, there should be a repeat lactate. And if you think there's been a significant change in patient condition, there should be a repeat lactate. So ideally, in the way the protocols are written, the repeat lactate should come in with no set time, but based on the patient response. But if we're playing in the real world, then if that hasn't happened, yeah, I think the 4 to 6 hour mark is very nice, or right before the patient goes upstairs, it'll give the floor team or the ICU docs an idea of where the patient's sitting. So that's all for this week. Check out those sepsis resources. Check out the handout at the show notes at mcrit.org. And as always, comments go on the website or on the Facebook page or email me directly. So this is Scott Weingart for the mcrit podcast. I will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.